Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is journalist David Finkel. Finkel is a writer and editor for The Washington Post. He has reported from Africa, Asia, Central America, and Europe. In 2006, he was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for a series of stories about U.S. democracy promotion in Yemen. He is also author of The Good Soldiers, a ground-level account of the 2007 Iraq War surge ordered by President George W. Bush. The Good Soldiers was named one of the best books of 2009 by the New York Times and best book of the year by the Chicago Tribune and the Boston Globe. The Good Soldiers was released in paperback by Picador Books last month. I'm speaking to David Finkel by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. David Finkel, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tish.
Now, the Good Soldiers, first of all, is a most astonishing book that I've probably ever read about war. So I want to set the scene. It's January 2007. President George Bush announces a new strategy for Iraq known as the Surge, and you end up with a battalion of Army infantry soldiers from Fort Riley, Kansas. Mm-hmm. They're among the first called to carry out this mission. To tell us about this scene.
Well, the surge was announced on January 10th, 2007. George W. Bush went on TV and finally announced what had been rumored for a few weeks. But there was an interesting thing. In the course of his speaking that night, at one point he said, "Many listening tonight will ask why this effort will succeed when previous operations to secure Baghdad did not. Well, here are the differences." And he went on from there to enunciate the differences he saw this time. But meanwhile, in Fort Riley, Kansas, was Lieutenant Colonel and a battalion commander named Ralph Koslerich, who was listening to the speech. And when Bush got to that part, Koslerich thought, "We're going to be the differences, my battalion, my soldiers, and me." And with an unbelievable sense of enthusiasm, optimism, guys filled with mission, and patriotism, off went this infantry battalion out of Fort Riley and into Baghdad to see what they could do in the surge. And the luck of the cards was they ended up in a pretty vicious area. They were there for 15 months. This was a battalion of 800-some soldiers, average age 19, most of these guys on their first deployment, mm-hmm. most eager to get there. And when they came home, they simply weren't the same men they had been when they left.
And you were what they call embedded with them during the 8-month period. Is that correct?
Yeah, they were on the ground in East Baghdad a total of 14 months. I was with them from the beginning to the end of their deployment. I would take occasional breaks to come do some reporting back in the United States, but I was on the ground living with them, among them, for about 8 months.
Yeah, it's an absolutely amazing story. Tell us a little bit more about Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Koslerich. He was so optimistic and so all-American. Can you describe how he changed during this mission?
Well, he is relentlessly optimistic and continues to be that way to this day. He's also, I can tell you from firsthand experience, a man who honors his word. When I had the idea of going to do this book, and I got in touch with him, I promised him that my intent was not to write a first-person book, not to write a policy book, not to write a book with any kind of agenda other than the story of what happened to him and his men. And he said, "If that's your promise, my promise to you is if you get here, you can have full access to everything we're doing." And he was good to his word. Whenever I was there, there was nothing barred. I could see whatever they were doing in an attempt to understand what their role was in this unfolding thing called the surge. His enthusiasm, you know, it's complicated, Tish. He's a commander. First of all, he's not going to let on to anyone underneath him if he's having any doubts. And, of course, there were times that he had doubts. Vicious area, and they had a tough deployment. And when soldiers began getting hurt, and when soldiers began dying and losing arms and losing legs and losing hands and eyes, he wasn't immune to feeling the pain of what these soldiers were going through. But it was his job to keep marshaling the troops, I guess, and that's what he did best. He kept people going.
Mm-hmm. Now, to tell us about the soldiers, you talk about how the average age was about 19 years old.
Yeah.
And you talk a lot about the fact that the recruiting situation in the United States forces has changed so much an increasing number of recruits needed waivers.
Sure.
And so tell us about that.
Well, the pressure to have enough troops is a tremendous pressure, and we're not in a conscription anymore. This is not a country that has a draft. It's a volunteer army.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep the numbers up and up and up and up, recruiters were recruiting from a pool of young men who often wouldn't be recruited from. And that's where the word waiver comes from.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of guys who were allowed into the army who, in gentler times, simply wouldn't have made the cut. They got waivers because of some kind of past transgression or bad behavior, up to, in a few cases, felonies.
Mm-hmm.
But the bodies were needed, and some of them were tossed out during basic training, but most of them got in and went to Baghdad. In some cases, remained problematic, but in most cases, at least from what I saw, there were a lot of instances of troubled young men turning into pretty decent soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Now, your book was particularly poignant in the ways that you try to explain the struggles that these soldiers had, trying to be decent human beings in these horrifying and dehumanizing conditions. So talk to us about some of the soldiers.
Well, it was such an extreme deployment. So many terrible things happened to these guys. And this area of East Baghdad, at that point in the war, the weapon of choice was a type of roadside bomb called an EFP, which, to describe it very quickly and very simply, was a tube of explosives. One end, there was a wire leading to a trigger and a guy standing in the shadows waiting for a convoy of soldiers to reach a certain point. And when the Humvees got there, he would press the trigger, the explosives would explode, and attached to the other end was a milled copper disc, maybe the size of a dinner plate, and it would move forward at such a high rate of speed it would become a semi-liquid, tadpole-shaped slug moving through the air, and it would simply burn whatever was in its way, and it would burn through the thickest part of the thickest door of the very best Humvee the U.S. Army was giving soldiers. It would just burn right through the door, and then it would burn through what was inside, which was five American soldiers. And so as this kept happening again and again and again, these soldiers began making to me these most heartbreaking daily calculations about what they would do when they went out on a mission, the way they would stand so as not to lose 2 feet but perhaps only 1 foot,
mm-hmm.
how to protect their hands, how to try to stay alive and in one piece against these things. So it was the small acts of calculations and also the small acts of, to use your word at the beginning of all this, decency that were the most moving to me. These were extreme circumstances, horrible, degrading circumstances for Americans, for Iraqis, for every single person involved in this drama. And on both sides, every day, you would just see small gestures of, I can't say tenderness, but I can say decency.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, the mission of the surge seemed to be pretty simple. It was to create a secure, self-sufficient environment for the Iraqi people. Did any of these soldiers try to calculate who the enemy really was in this horrifying situation?
Well, it did become less clear. You're right. The counterinsurgency strategy, the number one rule is if you can make the population feel safer, then everything will kind of trickle out from there and perhaps a war will turn and be won. But the enemy became less and less clear and distinct as time went on. This wasn't a conventional war and a conventional moment in the war. There wasn't any particular front line to advance toward. There weren't really predictable patterns of who might be friendly and who might be an enemy. Every time the soldiers went out, anyone they saw was capable of harming them, and there was evidence that they would be harmed. Mm-hmm. And every moment was so, I don't know, steeped in mistrust or the opportunity for mistrust. There might be the simple gesture of a kid at a roadside, a boy waving his hand at the soldiers. And it seems pretty innocent, but you had to think, was he waving or was he signaling to someone that now's the time to push the trigger? And then if you're a 10-year-old boy waving at a convoy of Americans, what are you seeing? You're seeing someone waving back, but the hand that's waving is encased in a glove, and it's behind a thick window, and the person is wearing bulletproof helmets, body armor, goggles, knee pads, arm pads. Just there's very little skin showing. There's very little human being showing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And these were the daily interactions of the surge.
You know, I want to ask you this, too. In 2007, many among the American people were losing any kind of commitment to this war. How were the soldiers affected by that? I know that you mentioned that they were watching TV and watching CNN, and so they were aware of this.
they felt quite disconnected from it. But all you had to do was go home, and the soldiers would get 18 days of leave to go home. And the disconnection that they suspected became so clear that they might move through an airport and people were waving and clapping for them. But for the most part, the war they were fighting over in Iraq was largely an afterthought to much of the American population. And that was their suspicion. And I have to say, there's basis for it. This is not a war that most Americans have been directly connected to. It's, mm-hmm. it's something distant. It's something that doesn't involve, in most cases, someone's son or husband. It was a volunteer army from a certain segment of the population heading to a strange place that most people didn't really read about.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, too, I know, since you spent so much time with these soldiers, were you able to have conversations with them about how much did they know about the Iraqi culture?
You have 800 guys, and I mm-hmm. think it depended on the guy. Some made great efforts to connect culturally and were grateful when Iraqis made similar gestures. And there were some guys who just could have cared less. They were there for what they thought was an adventure because they were eager to get to any kind of war and any kind of place and see what it was like to be a fighter. So it ran the range from culturally sensitive to, I think, culturally insensitive.
Mm-hmm. Well, was the Army making an effort to try to make sure these people had some cultural touchstones and education?
I think some is a good word. Everyone had a phrase book. Everyone had a bit of a general guidebook to cultural things going on, so there might not be misunderstandings. But what trumped everything was the violence of the place. And even if the soldiers suspected they might see something of war, they really did go over almost to a man feeling invincible. And then once the roadside bombs started going off and the soldiers themselves began getting hurt, invincibility faded. It became, in so many ways, physically and psychologically, a degrading experience. And so as time went on and the bombs kept exploding, and people who the soldiers thought they were trying to save wouldn't even call in and say there's a bomb at the corner of such and such a place, then insensitivities began replacing sensitivity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, I was fascinated by the fact that each chapter in your book was headed with a quotation from President Bush, and it really underscored this disconnect that we were talking about between what was happening on the ground and what the president was telling the American people. To talk to us a little bit about that. He would say things like, we're kicking ass, and
yeah.
Meanwhile you were reporting lost limbs, lost eyes.
The phrase that particular day illustrates it so vividly. Each chapter in the book does begin with a quote from then-President Bush, something he said around the time that the chapter unfolds.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of it wasn't to make Bush look silly or heroic. It was simply to emphasize how any war turns out to be two wars, the war that's being fought in Washington, in the Pentagon, at the White House, in the Capitol, the policy war and the money war. And the war on the ground at the far end of policy, the one being fought by soldiers. And September 4th, 2007 is such a perfect illustration of that. It is the day that George Bush landed in Australia, was overheard being asked by someone how the war was going, and his answer was, we're kicking ass. And that was his answer that day. And the book doesn't quarrel with that. It points that out as it then describes September 4th in East Baghdad in this battalion, which was a day another ESP went off into a Humvee. Two soldiers died on the spot. A third bled out a few minutes later on a road. A fourth lost both of his legs. And the fifth was a 19-year-old guy named Duncan Crookston, who on September 4th, in that moment, lost both of his legs completely, lost his entire right arm, lost most of his left arm, and was badly burned over what remained of him. And if I can just go on a little bit more, Tish.
Sure.
He didn't die. He was airlifted out to Germany and then to San Antonio, Texas, to Brooke Army Medical Center. And the months went by, and he didn't die. He was being taken care of by his mother, Lee, and his wife, Megan, both of whom uprooted their lives and moved from Colorado to be with him all the time. And at one point, the battalion commander, Ralph Kosserich, went home and went to visit his wounded soldiers in San Antonio, including Duncan. And when we talk about Kosserich's optimism, he had kind of a catchphrase every day when he would say, it's all good, no matter what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
that particular day, Tish, when he walked into the hospital room and saw Duncan, I mean, all he could really say was bastards under his breath as he went to the boy's bedside, because he was looking at something. It just didn't make sense. It was half of a man, bolted basically to a bed, wrapped in bandages, unmoving. And this is how he had been for 5 months. He had gone through 30 surgeries. His ears had fallen off. His nose had fallen off. His eyebrows and eyelids were gone. He was wearing goggles to bring moisture to his eyes and had drops of condensation on them. And swimming into his vision came Ralph Kosarich telling him, "We're winning the war. We're winning the war. We're doing it for you, Duncan." And there was no response from Duncan at all. And it went on like this for a while. And finally, Kosarich said, "Well, I'm going back to Iraq now, and my orders are to win the war, and your orders for me are to get better. Do you understand me?" And there was a slight nod from Duncan, and in that moment it became clear, heartbreakingly clear, he did understand things. He knew what had happened to him. He was aware of what he had become. And Kosarich went back to Iraq and walked into his office, turned on his computer, and there was an email waiting for him from Duncan's mother saying that Duncan had just died. And the email closed with a line that said, "Duncan, he would have been 20 years old tomorrow. He'll be forever 19 now and forever missed." So September 4th, 2007, we're kicking ass. That's one version of war. And the other version is the version that created Duncan Crookston.
Yeah, that was an incredibly moving story. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Finkel. We're talking about his book, The Good Soldiers. Now, David, I want to talk to you about the fact that this book is also unique in that you also brought real Iraqis into deeper focus, and we haven't gotten much of that during this war.
Right.
Tell us about Colonel Kosarich's translator, Izzy.
I thought it was important to bring as many Iraqi voices into the book as possible, but it was difficult. It was awfully difficult to move around the country at that point, and I'm used to being able to go wherever I want to as a reporter, but it was a dangerous point. There are Iraqi voices in the book, and one of them is the voice of a guy who went by the name Izzy, and it was a translator who was earning about $1,000 a month, an Iraqi national, to basically be the interpreter for Kosarich wherever he went, into meetings. Whenever he had to talk to an Iraqi, Izzy would be the translator. And Iraqis would say to Izzy, "What's wrong with you? You're such a traitor. Why are you working for the Americans?" And the pressure on Izzy was pretty severe. But he kept at it. He loved America. He loved America so much, or the idea of America, that among the few possessions he carried with him, honest to God, was a frequent flyer card from Pan American World Airways.
Yeah.
Izzy kept getting blown up in convoys because Kosarich did, and they were together. And there was another day, an awful day, when Izzy was home in Baghdad, and a particularly huge car bomb went off and destroyed his apartment building. And he took his daughter, who was very badly injured, to a hospital, and they turned her away because they simply didn't have room to care for her. He called the base where the soldiers were, where he worked, and asked if there was a way they could take care of his daughter. He was standing on a street with his bleeding daughter in his arms. And the rules are that if an Iraqi causes the problem, Americans don't really take care of injured Iraqis. But they found a way to bend the rules and get him on base and into the aid station. And it's one more thing, in a strange way, he's grateful for to America, that they saved his daughter in this war that was caused under such complicated circumstances.
Now, the theater in which these soldiers were conducting this war, it was so far from the green zone. Few politicians, few diplomats, nobody ever really went there except for these soldiers. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, it was quite a lonesome place, really. It was in Baghdad proper. In terms of miles, not that far from the green zone, but this is a place where people didn't go. The congressional delegations that would visit Baghdad occasionally, they never came to this place called Rustamaya. Other journalists didn't come there. Really, it was just one of those places filled with soldiers and under the radar and not getting much attention. But the war that was being fought out of there, that was the corner that's documented in this book. And at least because the soldiers finally came around to trusting me and letting me document what they were going through, now it's part of the record of the war.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the end of this deployment, how many of these guys think that they did make a difference?
It's an evolving question, or the answer is evolving. When they came home, toward the end, almost to a man, they were beginning to think they had made a difference because their area, so violent, was a bit calmer. But then something happened at the end that led to the worst violence and the worst fighting of the entire deployment. And at a time when the soldiers should have been packing to come home, they were in the worst combat of all. It had nothing to do with counterinsurgency at that point. It was just flat-out warfare. And it went on for 10 days, right up until the moment the helicopters came to take them out of there. And they came home pretty shaken by what they had been through at the end. And now it's a few years later, I'm in contact with a lot of these guys. And privately, they wonder, what in the world was that about? They think of the men lost. They think of their own physical wounds. And in a lot of cases, they're dealing with ongoing psychological trauma. And they're wrestling with the essential question, what was that? Was it worth it? And the answer is not an answer yet. It's still a question, but it's a disturbing one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and toward the end of the book, you do describe how these soldiers had to deal with the war within themselves once they got home. And many of them had mental, emotional problems and were on many prescription drugs.
Right.
It's just absolutely heartbreaking.
Well, I think a reasonable question now that the war seems to have reached the point where most Americans think it's over, that's a debatable question, whether the war is over.
Indeed.
But there is a perception that it's finished. At least the American part of it is just about done. But it's not a done war, especially with the soldiers who were in the midst of this and are still dealing with the fallout, with the consequences of it. One of the ways, I think, to understand what this country is facing now in terms of returning veterans is to understand what this was like at its worst. And this battalion was present during some of the very worst of it.
Mm-hmm. Have you gotten any commentary from people who were involved in this war, such as President Bush or any members of Congress who authorized this war in regard to your book?
No, I haven't. You know who I hear from is soldiers who were in the midst of it. I've gotten hundreds of emails. Honestly, hundreds of emails from soldiers saying, basically, Mr. Finkel, I read your book. I'm writing because when I came home, everyone wants to know what it was like, and I can't talk about it. So I ask people to read your book, and they'll understand what it was like and why I can't talk about it. And I get that email an awful lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me how this time affected you personally as a human being.
Well, probably the corniest line in the book is a note toward the end where I'm describing the methods I used to report the book, the methods of journalism, how most everything in the book was observed. And at some point, I say something like, I was honored to be there. I do feel that way. And I say that acknowledging the absolute corniness of the line. This is an important war in my lifetime. And what the soldiers were dealing with, what they were going through, I thought, did need recording, not in terms of a memoir, but in terms of some third-person observer trained in journalism coming over and watching and writing a book that's not an apology in any way for soldiers, but an unvarnished look at using the war to write about what war does to the character of young men. And because the soldiers, I guess over time, were willing to trust me more and more, I think I was able to do that, and that's why I use that word.
Mm-hmm. Are you doing any follow-up reporting about some of the soldiers now that they've been home for a while?
Yeah, the book came out, and I felt a little unsettled that the story had, I'd written half the story. And so I'm working on another book, the second volume in the story, about the attempts of some of these soldiers 3 years later to return to some form of normalcy here in America. And it's a very difficult book because while the first one, the one we're talking about, was physically scary, this is some really rough psychological territory these soldiers are traveling through and these ex-soldiers are traveling through. And again, we used the word decency earlier. They're decent young men and they're troubled young men because of what happened in Iraq.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was wondering, how did you stay safe?
How did I stay safe? How did anyone stay safe? You just sort of cross your fingers and hope for the best.
It was luck, huh?
I don't know. I got away with it. Nobody could have been there and escaped without being in the midst of some bad things, and that was the case with me. At the beginning, you know, I went out all the time. 5-6 days a week, I was in a Humvee going all around Baghdad, and in some explosions and the rest of it. By the time the deployment was finishing up, I don't mind telling you, I'd become quite scared. And I was ready for this to be done. And I was glad when the helicopter took off on April 10th and I got out of there and I was finally on my way home with the soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you had post-traumatic stress syndrome at all?
No. I was lucky. I had a few things, luxuries that soldiers didn't have. And first of all, I was there as an observer. I didn't carry a weapon. Mm-hmm. And so as much as I saw and as much as I attempt to understand what the soldiers went through, there is that separation. I didn't have to fire a shot. I think that's a huge thing. Number two, when it was getting to me, I had the luxury of being able to take a break. And so every month, month and a half, if I wanted to, I could come back to the United States to do some reporting. The Washington Post, where I work, also had a bureau in Baghdad, and I could manage my way there and just spend a few days just taking a break. And the soldiers didn't have that advantage either. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is, after it was over, I got to come home and write this book. I got to spend 11 months considering it, trying to make sense of what the notebook said these soldiers had been through, put it in the larger context, if you will. And that was a cathartic experience. That was really helpful, and it's something the soldiers don't have either. They come back, they get 30 days off to regroup a little bit, and then they're back at it, training for the next place to go, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
it really is a luxury to be able to consider what that was, because while you were there, it may make sense, but it's so abnormal. War is, even if it's a natural thing, it's so incredibly abnormal, the daily experience. And I'm just grateful I got to go home and be able to consider it.
Mm-hmm. David, we only have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you this. How long do you think it will take for the truth of this war to finally come out? You think it'll take years and many more reporters like you?
When you say the truth, what do you mean?
Well, like WikiLeaks is starting to bring out information that we had never heard and videotape that we had never seen. It feels like there's a lot of stuff that has been hidden about this war.
Well, let me answer it in one small way, which has to do with the surge itself. I cringe a bit when I hear people declare that the surge worked.
Mm.
It's simply too soon to know. Something happened. Something reduced violence, but whether it was the surge or whether it was other things going on at that point, ceasefires, the Anbar awakening, there were a lot of things kicking around. And someday a historian will be able to tease it apart and tell us what worked and what didn't with some authority. But you can't do it now because the war continues. It's simply too soon to know.
Mm-hmm. Well, David Finkel, thank you so much for joining us. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And all my listeners, please go out and buy The Good Soldiers. This is the most phenomenal book I've ever read about the war. Thank you so much, David Finkel.
Well, Tish, thank you very much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.